and more, and he joins us now to share his perspective on those and other leading issues here in the Tar Heel State. Governor McCrory, welcome back.
It's good to be back. Since I wasn't invited to Charlotte Squawks this year, I'm glad I at least got to come to WFAE Studios. So,
well,
you know,
you wouldn't answer your phone. What can
you
I
do? Didn't call. Eight years in a row on Charlotte Squawks. I held it up, and I got the what award did I get for that?
The MTA award.
Have you ever gotten the Have you ever got that?
Not for that show. No.
Is there a reason? Maybe that's why I wasn't invited. That I got it. And you didn't.
It was time to let others win. You spent the weekend with Carrie Underwood, I'm told.
I got to spend I got to hear in the governor's conference was in Nashville, Tennessee, and Carrie and Underwood and a lot of other countries. I saw Reba McEntire at the airport on the way back. That was kind of neat too.
You were in Nashville, right?
I was in Nashville, the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and I'm honored to say I just got elected to their board of directors for the National Conference of Governors.
Well, let's start with a topic that's been in the minds of the legislature and the general public for a long time, and that, of course, is teacher pay. There are disagreements between the House and Senate on exactly what pay should be, how it should be constructed, what trade-offs should be in place in order for teachers to get a pay raise. You and House Speaker Tom Tillis worked on your own plan, which we'll talk about. Why, given our focus in North Carolina, particularly since the Republicans took over, of making us as competitive as we can possibly be for businesses to come here and operate, why is there such dissension over how much to pay teachers in the state, which is 46th in education? Why wouldn't they put that at the top of the list and do something about that and make sure that we're not 46th?
It is at the top of the list, and that's why I've joined with the Mecklenburg School Superintendent, Mooresville School Superintendent, superintendents across the state, and teachers across the state to support a 5-6% pay raise, in which teachers, by the way, long before I came in the governor's office, were not getting pay raises. But we're doing it without cutting thousands upon thousands of teachers' assistants, and we're doing it without cutting Medicaid, which to the elderly, to the disabled, to Alzheimer's patients, I refuse to do that. And I've got to make sure the numbers make sense not only this year, but 2 to 3 to 4 years from now, and that's my job as governor.
If we hadn't cut taxes, would there have been that trade-off?
Well, we did tax reform. Now, if people want to change the tax reform, we had the highest income tax and the highest corporate tax in the Southeast, and I'm proud to say we changed that, and we're becoming more competitive in the nation. But in addition to that, now when you go to the movies, you have to pay 50 cents more to go to a movie, but your income tax is going to be reduced almost 2%. We also closed loopholes in taxes. So we had tax reform, which included tax cuts on income, which I'm an advocate of, because our income tax in North Carolina was becoming non-competitive. In fact, one of the highest, the highest in the Southeast.
You have said that the current teacher pay plan is outdated, old, and doesn't work in the 21st century.
That's
why?
Correct.
Why?
Because it's based upon only the length of time that a teacher works. And that works at a disadvantage to a fantastic teacher that might be great after 2 or 3 years or 4 years. And it doesn't take into consideration my new career teacher plan, which I think, if implemented in North Carolina, will be implemented across the nation, includes experience as part of your teacher pay, which, you know, wisdom, hopefully more experience, the better teacher you become. It includes the market demand. For example, if you're a math and science teacher, you might now make more than an English or a physical education teacher, because that's what the market demands, and the attrition rate in science and math is higher than any other part of teaching, and therefore you pay more to those teachers. So the market demand. We also look at hard to teach subjects and hard to teach schools in which you recruit. If a school is having difficulty recruiting teachers, we may have to pay a teacher more for that school or for that area of the state. And the second or the last two are the results, their performance. Are you having an impact on students' performance? And then the last is leadership. And this is something I've learned from – I've been out talking to teachers for the past year and a half, and your superintendent, Heath Morrison, he is really good. He said, Pat, there are certain teachers that are leaders within the teaching profession, and yet the only way they can get promoted is to become a principal or assistant principal. Well, frankly, some teachers we should want to stay in teaching and make more money in teaching, not have the only way to get promoted is to become an assistant or principal, because frankly, might not be what they want to do, and they might not be good at it.
You're talking about your career pathways for teachers.
That's correct.
So does that plan also reward teachers for furthering their education in their field of expertise?
Yes, and that's part of myself and Tom Tillis's plan, too, is to reinstate master's pay, but in the area in which you teach, not just a master's in anything that's totally non-relevant to what you're teaching.
Now, I'm not a teacher, and I'm not an expert in education, but all the things that you've talked about, rewarding teachers for experience, for performance in the classroom, for teaching at hard-to-staff schools, for teaching market-based subjects that are in demand, for leadership among their peers, mm-hmm. all of those things sound very sensible to me. Why is there argument in Raleigh among the House, the Senate, and the governor's office about these things? Because some of these plans that have been floated up there
sure.
were going to not reward teachers for going back to school. They were going to not reward experienced teachers. After 35 years, no more raises for you, buddy.
Yeah.
We want to reward the beginning teachers, which didn't make any sense at all to me.
Well, there is a limit at for any job in any corporation or any business. There's a certain max for certain types of pay for any profession, regardless of how much experience you have. There usually is a max in any job performance or any job interview or any job position. But I think this is where it's coming from. The left, the unions, don't want any type of differential in pay, regardless of performance, regardless of anything, because they want everyone to be paid the same. And they think if this is primarily the left unions who have problems with any type of differential in pay. That's more the civil service mentality. I have people on my far right who think, well, it ought to be performance only. And that should be the only criteria, when in fact I think it should be a combination of factors.
And how do you judge performance?
I'm going to let the locals determine that and not let Raleigh determine that. I want to give flexibility to the superintendents, the principals. You know, when you and I went to school, we all knew who the good teachers were.
You're right.
Everyone knows who the good teachers are
right.
and who were the ones that were having an impact on the students, and those that were natural leaders, and those that were training other teachers, and those that you know, we're teaching the tough subjects. I think we can do that and give more flexibility to the local school system to determine how to best measure this criteria in each school system, and let the Heath Morrisons and the Clarks and so forth determine how best to reward teachers, not let Raleigh decide that or not let Washington decide that.
Now, as I understand it, you moved from advocating a 3% raise for teachers to a 6% figure, which is in line with the House budget. The Senate plan, which you have vowed to veto, calls for an 11% raise for teachers after so many years of pay stagnation for the state's teachers. What's your objection to 11%? Sounds nice to me.
Sounds nice to you until you lay off 6,000 teacher assistants to pay for it. And most teachers, in fact, almost all the teachers I've talked to, when I made my proposal, even at 3%, I had many superintendents and teachers standing next to me. No one is standing next to the people proposing the 11% pay raise, because it comes at the expense of laying off 6,000 to 7,000 teacher assistants. We need the teacher's assistants, especially in first, second, third grade. And also, it comes at the expenses. I'd have to cut Medicaid and North Carolina services to some of the elderly, the poor, Alzheimer's patients, and people who are blind and deaf. And I'm not going to do that.
Why is Medicaid the only thing you can take money from?
Because Medicaid's about 25% of the budget, and that's where the big bucks are being spent right now. And the other part, the major part of the budget, is education. So you steal from one to pay for the other, and I'm not going to do that.
Senate Leader Phil Berger issued a statement in reaction to your threatened veto of any budget containing teacher pay raises in excess of 6%, in which he said he was surprised by your willingness to reject the largest teacher pay raise in the state's history, while also demanding the budget without cuts to teachers' assistance and Medicaid, despite the fact that your own budget includes almost $20 million in cuts to teacher assistance, along with what he described as, quote, significant, though ultimately unachievable, cuts to Medicaid.
His facts are incorrect. Now, we'd reduced the growth of teachers' assistance in past budgets, but we all agreed to, including Phil and including almost all the legislature, that we shouldn't cut any more teachers' assistants, and we're primarily going to focus teachers' assistants in first, second, and third grade. Because by third grade, if they're not, kids aren't reading, we're in trouble. Mm-hmm. And I might add, this is not just a Republican issue. This is a House Democrat and Republicans voted unanimously for this plan, unanimously, in the House of Representatives in Raleigh. Under Tom Tillis's leadership. In the Senate Democrats are standing on the sideline and recommending nothing, and the Senate Republicans are demanding a pay increase, frankly, that teachers don't want at the expense of teachers' assistants, and they have told me this, and neither does the school superintendent of Mecklenburg County. They're demanding something that the state, it's not financially reasonable, not just this year, but in future years, we would have a very difficult time paying for increases, not only for teachers, but that means we won't be able to pay future community college professors who deserve pay raises, state employees who deserve pay raises, and also university professors who need pay raises also. So this is not the only bucket where we need to give pay raises. I also need to give pay raises and have money left over for other professions within state government that are very important to not only education. I've got nurses right now that I have to pay in mental health and other areas that, frankly, are underpaid, paid less than teachers, and they work 12 months out of the year. Mm-hmm. I have highway patrol officers who are being paid far less than Charlotte-Mecklenburg officers and even some less than teachers that work 12 months out of the year. So I have other pay issues in state government that I also have to be responsible for.
Phil Berger went on to say that it would be more helpful for you to work with members of both chambers since your, this is a quote, unwillingness to listen to those who have an honest disagreement with you on spending priorities in favor of staging media stunts and budget gimmicks is a major reason the budget has not been finalized. This is a fellow Republican.
Yeah.
These are strong words.
You know, when Republicans, I used to be critical of Democrats when they controlled the Senate, Bass, Knight, and Rand, when I was mayor of Charlotte. And when they, made some arrogant moves, I called them out on it. And at this point in time, when the Senate Republicans and some of the Senate Democrats, I believe, walked out on our school superintendent right here in Mecklenburg County and some of the best teachers in North Carolina out of a hearing, those are the people we need to be listening to. And that's who I've been listening to for the past year and a half, in addition to my education advisor. I've been listening to the people in the classrooms, not to just other politicians. And that's what we've got to do a better job of doing both in Washington and in Raleigh, is listening to the people on the front lines, and that includes the teachers, the principals, and the superintendents. And that's why when we made our announcement, yes, a staged announcement, it was teachers and superintendents who were standing next to us, including the superintendent of Mecklenburg County. And again, Heath has been one of the ones who've been helping give these ideas. These ideas that I presented were not developed by me. They were developed by people, teachers and principals and superintendents. And that's who should be developing teacher pay plans and teacher performance plans.
So the Senate won't listen to the teachers? They won't listen to the superintendent?
All I can say is there's no one standing next to the Senate when they propose their pay increase, and there's a reason for that. They will not do it at the expense of other state employees or at the expense of Medicaid patients or at the expense of thousands of teachers' assistants who may get layoff notices within the next several weeks, which is totally unacceptable to me.
Governor Pat McCrory, our guest, will come back and talk more about teaching and education and more in a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Vein Center of Charlotte, now offering the Smart Skin CO2 Laser for Laser Facial Resurfacing. More information at 704-341-1122 or veincenterofcharlotte.com. Experts in the medical field are hopeful that we are getting ever closer to the day when treatment for whatever ails you will be personalized. Personalized medicine. It's a relatively new field of research, some of which is taking place right here in Charlotte, and if perfected, it would replace that one-size-fits-all approach that we use today, and based on a simple blood or urine test, you'd find treatments targeted just for you. We'll find out more about this targeted therapy or research into this way of doing business, medically speaking, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show. After decades of advocating abstinence to treat alcoholism, some experts now say the cold turkey approach is not the best for everyone, looking beyond the 12-step model to new treatments for alcohol addiction.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Squawks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Governor Pat McCrory is our guest today.
If only they could hear our off-air comments, some which you cannot say on the air.
Many times I have said that the show off the air is much better than the show that's on the air. But that's why we're not just a podcast.
We're still debating Charlotte Squawks at this point in time.
You sent out a press release last week, I believe, in which you said that you have committed to clearing your calendar this week to meet with any House or Senate member personally to communicate your resolve and communicate to teachers who are waiting in limbo as the school year approaches. I want to understand the process because the power in North Carolina resides with the House and Senate.
In legislation.
So how much can you, as the governor, push buttons, jab elbows?
I did it with tax reform last year. The Senate Republicans came up with kind of a tax reform that I thought went too far and would put at risk our budget. And the House was a little more moderate, and I was probably somewhere in between. And I brought major legislative leaders into a conference room in the old state capitol building built in 1841 and basically locked the door and brought some bologna sandwiches in and said, "We're not leaving here until we get it resolved." And I may have to do the same thing here with this. But the problem is with the tax reform, we had some room for compromise. I've now moved from 3% to 6% pay raises. Again, which I'm great to give 6% pay raises. I think it's fantastic, considering that my predecessors and others did not give pay raises. But I've got to do it in which it's affordable and it's sustainable. I want a long-term teacher compensation plan, not just a one-year political hit that looks good for the next election. I want a plan that lasts for a decade or two that teachers can be that is dependable, reliable, and makes sense on which teachers are rewarded and, frankly, which ones aren't.
I mean, I think you should be given kudos for raising teacher pay, but I think also we have to clarify perhaps why your predecessors didn't give pay raises, and I think you're talking about Beverly Perdue, who presided over the Great Recession.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nobody was getting raises.
They got one. Some people were getting raises, but you're right. Listen, people weren't getting raises the last 5 or 6 years. The protest against teacher pay raise started in my first week in office. They weren't going on a week before I was sworn in, so there is some politics here where people started protesting me within my first 2 weeks in office on this issue, recognizing there are still financial struggles in this state and with the economy.
How would you characterize your relationship? I know you obviously have a good one with Tom Tillis because you've come, to, at least on this one issue, you've come together.
Tom and I work extremely well together.
But then you have Phil Berger in the Senate who is taking you to task. How would you characterize your relationship with the legislature?
It's kind of interesting. The legislature in the past decade has been – the Senate has tended to be, for whatever reason, the most powerful branch. They call themselves almost a separate branch of government when it's one part of one branch of government. You know, Bassnight and Rand have often said when the Democrats totally controlled state government for over 20 years, many people said Bassnight and Rand were running the legislature, even despite Jim Black and others. And I think some of my Senate Republicans, when they finally got the majority, they said, "We're going to try to replicate." In fact, Tom Apodakis is quoted in newspapers saying that Tony Rand was his role model. And he'd like to use that same technique. Well, that's frankly the culture that I wanted to change because when I was mayor of Charlotte here for 14 years, whether it was Republican or Democrat, I don't think two or three legislators ought to have that much control and power, and they ought to give release and allow other senators to vote on pieces of legislation that for whatever reason is not being brought to the floor. I mean, that's the stuff Harry Reid does in D.C. right now, doesn't let certain votes come up, or the Speaker does. And I frankly think we need to unleash people and allow them to vote. Heck, I can't even get the puppy mill. My wife and I are pushing a puppy mill bill vote and the House of Representatives, Republicans and Democrats, voted some great new standards to protect puppies. And the Senate leadership won't let it get on the floor.
We actually did a program on this not too long ago, and evidently there are no regulations in North Carolina governing puppy mills.
It's terrible.
Why not? Why are there no? Why is there a puppy mill lobby powerful enough to prevent these laws?
I can't figure it out, but there is a puppy mill lobby. Some of it comes out of the ag industry because they're afraid it will then apply to the agricultural. And there's some of it's coming from that. And there's some justification because sometimes the United States Humane Society versus the North Carolina or Charlotte go way too far. But, you know, that's an example of even the puppy mill bill, which is important to me, but, you know, it's in a different stratosphere than tax reform or education reform. The Senate ought to vote on it and let senators vote on it, but the leadership is stopping that from happening, and that's unacceptable.
In addition to the Career Pathways for Teachers plan, which we've talked about, you have you want to increase funding for early childhood education, seek salary supplements for teachers who earn advanced degrees, establish scholarship funds for newly separated veterans who could then turn around and use that money to go to the University of North Carolina system, and provide state employees with raises of $1,000, including benefits. And for those people who don't pay for their own health insurance, that's about 30%, 33, 35% more. Will this make it through the legislature? And if it does, where will the money come from?
Well, it's been coming from primarily because, first of all, for the first time in 5 years, our Medicaid costs did not have cost overruns.
Why?
I mean, when I came in, real quick, when I came into office, we had a $535 million misforecast. That was really the main reason there wasn't teacher pay raises in the previous years, was because the Medicaid forecasts were so far off. If we would have not had that $535 million in my first year, we probably could have given teacher pay raises even with a bad economy. Last year it was about $90 million, and this year we actually had a slight surplus, partly because we're doing better forecast, we're managing the system better, and we're really targeting some of the overlap between duplications and applications. And we think we're going to see improvement in that area in upcoming years now that we get the computer systems all fixed and all the other stuff going on with Obamacare.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Medicaid, because we asked listeners through social media over the weekend to share their concerns and questions. And here's one from Renee, who asked, why exactly did you and the other North Carolina officials decide not to expand Medicaid, something that more than half of the country has already chosen to do, when there are astoundingly high numbers of low-income individuals who need that type of help and who do not possess the resources to explore other avenues of health care? And along similar lines, Bill asks, why do you hate the president more than you care about the citizens of North Carolina that need medical care? How do you sleep at night?
That's nice. He's
referring, obviously, to the state's decision not to expand Medicaid.
Well, let me first say,
because of the Affordable Care Act.
First of all, I don't hate the president. In fact, the president and I have a good relationship. In fact, Joe Biden and I hugged each other the other day in Nashville, Tennessee, and right on stage in front of everybody. I have a great deal of respect for the president. I happen to disagree with Obamacare, but I respect him and I respect the office. And if you know, during my 14 years as mayor here, I've worked with President Clinton, I worked with President Bush, I worked with President Obama, and I'll always show respect for that office, and you'll never see me saying something derogatory toward another office or especially the President of the United States. But the reason we didn't expand Medicaid based upon – that's part of Obamacare in North Carolina. Most people don't – that is, expanding Medicaid was part of Obamacare, which then the Supreme Court in the 441 ruling allowed the states to make the determination on whether they on their own would expand Medicaid or not. It gave us the choice.
Right.
And we decided not to because, first of all, the existing Medicaid system in North Carolina is broken. And the Medicaid system for the elderly, the poor, the disabled, and women and children was broken and it still is in North Carolina. And I felt, before you expand something, why don't you fix the services to those people in which Medicaid was originally designed?
Why hasn't it been fixed?
Well, we've had 15 months, and I'm going to need more than 15 months, but we're seeing great improvement. And that's one reason Aldona Voss and myself are recommending Medicaid reform, in which we have one-stop service for Medicaid patients, where instead of going to an orthopedic person here and to a heart doctor here and going to an internist here, we see them all at once. In fact, I wish we had this medicine for everyone. we call it through ACOs, Accountable Care Organizations. And that would provide better services. And the medical community is supporting this Medicaid reform. And again, the House is supporting it too. The Senate's holding it up.
How is that not the state telling you what doctor to see, which is something that the Republicans railed against?
No, in fact, you're getting to see a lot of doctors. Okay. We're not telling them what doctor to see. We're saying you get to see them all at once in the same building.
Okay.
And that then will save cost, and that will also provide better service. And it's called Accountable Care Organizations in North Carolina.
So you have to create these organizations.
No, they're already
you?
Created.
All right.
They're already created. In fact, Aldona Voss and I met with some in Winston-Salem. We've met with some in Winston. These are organizations that are already in place, and they streamline the services, reduce costs, but provide better care. If we continue on this Medicaid escalation of cost, it's unaffordable.
But in the meantime, there are a lot of people who cannot take advantage of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare because they fall into that donut hole where they have to get extra services from Medicaid, and we haven't expanded Medicaid, therefore they can't get the services. What about those people?
Right now, many of them actually can qualify for Obamacare, with all due respect. That's what Obamacare was designed for. And so I disagree with that. But
there are people who fall into that
hole.
There
are people, but the last thing I'm going to do is harm other people who are not getting – Medicaid, when Lyndon Baines Johnson created this program in the 60s, was meant to be for women, children, the disabled, the young and the young children in certain financial groups, the poor.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we fix it for them first before we expand it? Those are the people that the system was designed for, and we've got to do better with them before we bankrupt the state in expanding the system. And right now, there's no way we know how that would be paid for in the next 3 years. The federal government's offering it for free for the next 2 years. No one really knows how it's going to be paid for 3 to 4 to 5 years.
So let's be clear, because you said this the last time you were here. Let's be clear about this.
Sure.
You turned it last time you were here, if I recall correctly, you said the state turned it down because it's free from the federal government.
We turned it down
for 2 years, and then the state has to pick up the tab.
No, picks up 10% of the tab.
And we can't afford to pick up 10% of the tab?
10% of what? No one knows what that 10% number is.
Okay.
No one knows what that 10% number is, and frankly, no one really trusts Congress at that point in time on how much longer that would be.
According to recent surveys,
I never buy something when I don't know what the real cost is going to be down the road.
The Affordable Care Act is becoming popular in places where it's being taken advantage of. There are people, even Republicans, who say, I like what I'm getting under. I like the fact that I can't be turned down for pre-existing conditions. I like the fact that my 24-year-old son, who doesn't have a job yet, even though he's out of college, can stay on my policy. I like the fact that I can get insurance and I can get it at an affordable rate. It's becoming more popular. So as it does,
of the surveys saying that are a little slanted, by the way. I think you've been watching the Bill Maher show too much.
Do you see?
You heard this on Bill Maher. Come on.
No.
Where are you getting your stats?
Do you see a day when North Carolina...
I'd love to see your stats on this.
Do you see a day when North Carolina will expand Medicaid for the Affordable Care?
I'm leaving that door open. Once we fix the current system, I have not closed the door as governor on... And in fact, I met with the new Health and Human Services Secretary yesterday, myself and the other governors, Chris Christie, Walker, Democratic governors from Connecticut and Nebraska and others, had a wonderful meeting. And what we're trying to figure out is how can we get more waivers to adapt to what North Carolina needs are. So, for example, if I expand Medicaid, can we do it in a strategic way instead of across the board, do a better definition if we do expand it and get more assurance of what our true cost will be 3 or 4 years down the road, regardless of who the governor might be. The second thing, by the way, we had a major conversation on with the Secretary of Health and Human Services, who was very impressive. She's got the hardest job in the nation at this point in time, is we could have this immigrant issue impacting North Carolina within a very near future on what's happening on the border of California and Arizona and Texas. There's a possibility that a lot of states now are being asked to take some of these immigrants.
Are you talking about the kids or are you talking
about the kids?
Yeah.
The kids, and not knowing who their sponsors are. I mean, there's a huge issue. They say, well, we won't do it without a sponsor. And we ask the secretary, well, who are the sponsors? Are they undocumented or illegal sponsors? And they went, we don't know. And we said, well, how do you do a background check on these sponsors? And then how do we deal with the foster homes? How do we deal with Medicaid, which could increase our Medicaid costs? And how do we deal also with education? So there are some huge issues that governors are going to have to work with the Obama administration during the next literally several weeks, even on this issue, which also could impact Medicaid within a very short period of
are,
time.
Are most of the governors in the country Republicans?
I think 31 governors.
So the majority are Republicans, slight majority.
30, I think. I'm not sure.
Given that the states are having to handle the immigration, the results of our broken immigration system, the states are bearing the burden of this. Why don't the governors, the Republican governors, push the Republican Congress to do something?
We are. We're pushing both the president, Republican Congress, to do something, and Democrats. The problem is, what does immigration reform mean? And that's where the real breakdown is. And by the way, it also includes protecting our border, just like we protect our airport. You know, when people come to Charlotte Douglas International Airport and they fly in and they go through passport checks, we have pretty strict standards there. We don't just open it up and say, hey, come on in, we'll come get you later, maybe. And that's the way our border is right now. Why is it at Charlotte Douglas International Airport we have all these security, and when you get off from Europe or anywhere in the world in Charlotte, we have all this security that you have to show who you are and where you're going and when you're going to return, and yet at our own borders we do not have that at this point in time.
You recently vetoed an unemployment bill because you said it would shorten the terms in office for members of a board that rules on appeals of unemployment board decisions, the members of which you appointed last December. So where does that bill stand now?
And I think hopefully it'll get through. The House passed a new bill, which basically sustains my veto, and now the Senate hopefully will pass it. Little politics there. I appointed a Democrat, former Democratic mayor of Greensboro, on the Unemployment Commission, which I thought it should have been a bipartisan commission. And then I appointed two others. And frankly, I had a state legislator who wanted the job, and I did not give it to her.
Okay.
And so these are the top of politics, and I'm trying to change the culture of Raleigh, whether it's Republicans or Democrats. I frankly don't care. I'm gonna make my appointments the right way, and whether it be Republican or Democrat. And when they get the appointments and they get a four-year commitment, they should be given that four-year commitment.
Jim on Facebook writes about something I don't know anything about. Could the governor please comment why he didn't include LGBT people in his workplace non-discrimination statement and signing? I know he said he was following federal guidelines, which do not include protections for LGBT people. Does he support employment non-discrimination for those folks? And wouldn't he want North Carolina to be a leader in this area?
I have to follow state law, and I have to follow federal law. I'm sworn to uphold the Constitution of the United States of North Carolina, but I will say this. The only reason a person should be fired in the state of North Carolina is because of their job performance and nothing else.
But how do you provide protections for people who don't believe what you believe?
As governor, that's exactly what we're talking about, job protection regarding state employees and others. And I make sure that we deal with job performance. And by the way, I also firmly believe that we ought to have a little more flexibility and be able to fire some state employees that have too much protection. Right now, the average appeal process is over 400 days to take any action toward an underperforming state employee.
And with that, we must stop. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Business North Carolina magazine, covering the economy, industry, and business of North Carolina each month. July focuses on education with subscriptions online at businessnc.com and at the App Store. After decades of relying on abstinence to treat alcoholism, some experts now say that the cold turkey approach isn't the only way. And guests on the Diane Rehm Show will be talking about that in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, new ways of treating alcoholism. If you'd like to join our conversation, Facebook, Twitter, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. And today only, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323. We're coming right back with Governor Pat McCrory in a moment.
Yeah. Hi, this is Ari Shapiro, and when I'm not reporting from around the world, I sometimes sing with a band called Pink Martini. And if you think your old car has seen better days, try riding around in the back of a band van after 3 weeks on tour. When the time comes to upgrade your ride, donate it to this station. You'll get a tax break, and we'll tow it away for free. Turn your car into the programs you love. Here's how.
Call 1-866-789-8627 or go to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Governor McCrory is our guest today, Pat McCrory.
I can't believe the joke you just told me off air.
You point to I have no idea what you're talking about. You point to unemployment reform measures already taken as a success in terms of reducing the unemployment rate in North Carolina. So you're saying, and I think there's some evidence to prove this is true, the Republican mantra.
You say that in such surprise.
Well, I'm not. I'm just saying that some people said when Republicans were cutting back on unemployment insurance and cutting the amount of money and cutting the time, people said you were being cruel. And now there is some evidence to point out that it actually caused people to go back to work. Now the question becomes, did they go back to work in jobs that they hate or in jobs that have no future for them simply because they had to eat? And if they had held out a little longer, they might have gotten a job that fit them better. Is that the way to go? I guess
the answer is probably yes to both. First of all, when I came into office, North Carolina's unemployment rate was 9.4%, I think 8.9 adjusted. It's now down. We've had the fastest drop in unemployment rate in the country next to Florida. We're down to 6.4%. And I think one of the reasons is we did not extend unemployment as most other states did, what the administration wanted us to do. We didn't do it for two reasons. One is we owed the federal government $2.5 billion and had no way to pay it back. We've now reduced that to less than $1 billion that we owe the federal government. Most people in North Carolina had no idea that we owed the federal government. North Carolina owed the federal government that much money. And the second reason is we had the ninth highest unemployment compensation in the country. And we were much higher than Tennessee, Virginia, and South Carolina. And the third reason is I was having employers, many employers across the state, including right here in Charlotte, say, I've got job openings and people aren't taking them. And many times people are saying, I'm waiting to see if unemployment will be extended.
Right.
So I will tell you, yes, there are some people who probably took jobs they didn't want instead of staying in unemployment. And by the way, in my career, I've taken jobs that I don't want. You've taken jobs you don't want. But it gets you in the door, it gets you working, and it gets you off the government payroll, which is unaffordable and unattainable with a $2.5 billion deficit that we owed the federal government. So we're paying back our debt. More people are accepting jobs, and more people are then be able to show off their skills and maybe get promoted or look for jobs while they have a job, which is the best way to look for a job, by the way. I'm an old recruiter.
To have a job.
Have a job while looking for a job is much better.
Let me go back to Medicaid. Jenny emails, why is reforming North Carolina Medicaid and accepting the federal funds to expand it mutually exclusive? You point out 10% of what doesn't make sense. 10% is quite low for getting the other 90%. If you improve North Carolina Medicaid, then you have even more dispensable money for people who need it. Does that make any sense to you?
Somewhat. Actually, I don't disagree with a parallel track, but I'm concentrating on Medicaid reform, and we're also working on some mental health reform because the mental health system here is very, very broken, where so many mental health patients are being just dropped off at the emergency rooms or in our county jails. So I agree with some of that comment. I'm looking at potential waivers down the road. But at the same time, the most important thing right now is we've got to control the cost of Medicaid. It has been escalating so much that frankly, has impacted how much teachers make, how much community college teachers make, how much money we have with our roads. We cannot sustain the increased cost in Medicaid, not just in this state, but in all states in the United States.
So to put a cap on Medicaid here, Ben on Twitter writes, when will Medicaid be fixed enough to expand it through the Affordable Care Act?
I don't know yet. I've got it. The House of Representatives in the state accepted the Medicaid reform Right now, there's a major battle within the medical community between managed care systems and the county care organizations on whether you want out-of-state managed care, some for-profit to come in and take over your system, or do you want to try to work within the system you have. I'm trying to work out a compromise between the two. And I'm telling you, the lobbying on all groups, from hospitals, from doctors, from the insurance companies, from lawyers, you name it, I've never seen so much aggressive lobbying in my life. And I frankly have irritated all groups, because we're trying to come up with a system that is long-term sustainable. And frankly, the hospitals are going to have to make some sacrifice. Doctors are going to have to make some sacrifice. And so are the insurance companies.
Let's bring in some more listeners to this conversation. John in Charlotte, welcome. You're on with Governor McCrorie.
Good morning, Mike and Governor McCrorie.
Hey, John.
I've noticed lately, well, in the last 2 years or so, North Carolina was ranked probably in the bottom third for business climate, and suddenly we've shot up to like the top five for, you know, businesses to come do business to come to. What have you or the legislature done in the last couple of years that made it so appealing for companies to come here?
Well, thank you, John. I think North Carolina's had a good business climate in the past, but then our costs started increasing, including the debt that we owed the federal government. We also, our taxes were the highest in the Southeast, and frankly, we are also having some major issues with government and even corruption in government, and I think we've made a positive impact in all three. I think our tax reform is making a difference. I think our paying off our debt to the federal government is making a difference, and I want to compliment Sharon Decker, who's from the Charlotte region and used to be president of the chamber here and one of the best salesman this state's ever had. She is also reforming our Commerce Department to make it more customer-friendly and make it quicker and more adaptable to recruit businesses. And I also am very proud of our transportation reform, where Tony Tata, my cabinet secretary, former one-star general, served in Afghanistan and Iraq. We are now actually building roads not based upon where the politicians live, but based upon where the congestion is and where safety matters are. And this really stepped on the good old boy network of North Carolina. You know, when you used to drive to the beach, you know, where the highway would go from 2 lanes to 8 lanes, back to 2 lanes, and you'd always go, what the heck's going on here? And wherever it was widest, it was named after a North Carolina politician. Mm. Well, that probably meant it was done for politics. So I think we're
couldn't
becoming
we
more the, efficient, more
we
friendly.
Have the Pat McCrory spur to Huntersville and Davidson?
They used to call the light rail line the McCrory line, but I don't think that was a compliment. But now that it's working, it's called the blue line, and that's good. I'm very proud of the mass transit line.
Now you're falling back on old Charlotte Squawks humor. Let's go to Steve in Charlotte.
Oh, yeah, Charlotte. You mean the one you didn't invite me to?
The very one. Steve, go ahead. Welcome. You're on WFAE. Oh, I'm sorry, Steve. Right. Now you can go.
Hey, Steve.
Go ahead.
Governor McCrorie, I just returned from a three-week trip throughout Asia. And they are looking very closely at what North Carolina is doing as far as tax reform, corporate support, and things of that sort. But what are your plans to piggyback off of the tax reform to recruit more foreign businesses from that region?
That's a great question. First of all, I'm looking at some trade issues right now, and I'm starting to talk with the federal government about trade issues that are working for and against North Carolina. The second thing we're looking at is revamping our ports, both at Morehead and Wilmington, which we think impacts some of our export business, especially in agriculture, especially to Asia. And for example, in my fifth or sixth month in office, we recognized we didn't even have refrigeration at the Wilmington port. Well, how can we do exports to Asia when we don't have refrigerators at Wilmington or the Morehead port? So those are the type of infrastructure improvements that we're making. So we have some sort of competitive niche against Charleston, Savannah, and Norfolk, which, by the way, in our different spheres. The other thing is I continue to work with the airlines to make sure that we can keep and even expand our international flights, because one thing we realized to Asia, to get Asian business, they've got to have better access to North Carolina. And that's, you know, that's one of the major advantages that we have here.
And with the intermodal facility at the Charlotte Airport, that's supposed to make us an inland port, essentially.
And Greensboro also, we think, has a great potential for a hub.
Well, we don't care about that.
I do.
We only care about Charlotte.
Sorry.
And what about your support for the airport? Who runs the airport? Where do you stand on that issue? I know that you said that we ought to be able to decide
I think it should belong to Charlotte. And I think the politicians ought to get out of it.
Why are they in it? You know all the players. Why did they kick up this ruckus? And it's the Mecklenburg delegation who started it all. Why did they do that?
They were asked to by members of the business community.
Why?
Because some of the Charlotte, supposedly, and it could be true, some of the Charlotte politicians were getting too active in the day-to-day operations of Charlotte Airport. And frankly—
But that would be illegal, wouldn't it?
No, it's not illegal. In our form of government in Charlotte, the Charlotte politician should let the city manager and the director of the airport run the airport and the day-to-day operations. Mm-hmm. It's up to the city council to set the vision and the long-term 50-year plan for the airport, and that's what I did. And I was proud of the third parallel runway, which we started that planning back in 1995-96 period.
So you don't have any fear that the local politicians will start mucking up things at the airport if they were left alone?
I think they started to. Mm. I think there was a process where there was too many day-to-day involvement in operations, and I think that's what Jerry Orr was complaining about. It. But by the way, I don't think the state politicians ought to do the same thing.
Okay.
I think both the state politicians and the Charlotte politicians ought to get the heck out of the operations of the airport. I went all the way out to Arizona to meet with the head of the U.S. Airways, mm-hmm. and you know that's what they basically said. Let us run the airport like a business, because it really is a business. Kind of like our water system is a business.
U.S. Airways is telling you, let us run the airport like a business?
Let us, Charlotte.
Charlotte
run the airport like a business, which is, frankly, we've done a good job in doing that for the past 25 years. And frankly, as mayor, I stayed out of the airport day-to-day operations. I was very active in the master plan for the airport and the intermodal and the third parallel runway. But I didn't call up Jerry Orr every day and tell him what contracts he ought to be signing or how to run the baggage claim. That's what we ought not be doing, and we shouldn't be doing that with our water system either. And not only did I do that, Richard Vindrid didn't do that, right. Harvey Gantt didn't do that. And I think as the time went on, we were starting to do what other politicians did in other cities, and that was get involved in day-to-day operations. And we shouldn't do that. And I don't want the state politicians doing it either, including this governor.
Okay, let's go to Mark. I don't know where Mark is calling from, but Mark's on the line. Welcome.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Fine. My question is, it's actually a statement. As a frontline operator of a small business in Charlotte, dry cleaning and restoration, I just want to know, I want to tell you how well it's been the last probably 6 to 8 months. I have people coming in applying for jobs that for 2 or 3 years before that, I had to struggle to try to find somebody to work. And I just wanted to thank you for making it available and making small businessman's job easier because as a frontline person, it's amazing just the last 6 to 8 months, I must have 3 to 5 people a week come in and apply for a job.
I'm getting that feedback all over the state, where before a lot of times, based upon unemployment rules, they'd apply for the job but not want to take it if it's offered. And now people are taking the jobs that are being offered. And again, it might not be their dream job, but it gets them in the door. It gets them to prove their skills, and it gets them to look at other opportunities while employed and while off unemployment, which again was another very similar to Medicaid. We were extending unemployment. My predecessor in the legislature was extending unemployment, having no idea how they were going to pay it back. Most people didn't realize that money was borrowed by the state of North Carolina, and we didn't have a payment plan on how to pay it back. And we were increasing taxes on business to pay back the interest, not even the principal, on the debt. And had we extended unemployment, our debt would be over $3 billion right now to the federal government. And President Obama should not have, and he would not have, forgiven that debt.
We have people who have – thank you for your call, by the way, Mark. We have people who have been emailing and Facebooking, and we have two callers who want to know about the same thing, and that is film incentives.
Yeah.
Because you want to employ people. Here's an industry that is clean – that does bring in money to the state, that does create jobs, not just people who are in front of the camera or running the camera, but people who are serving lunch and driving people to and from set locations and building sets and making costumes and props for, you know, an industry that has spawned a lot of television and movies.
I've been in three of them.
Well, and I'm sure you're an Emmy winner or have an Oscar now.
You should. Well, you're a little envious still.
Absolutely. So where does that stand? Because the film incentives are scheduled to expire at the end of the year, and this seems to be a good industry to have in North Carolina and one that we have built up over the
I am supporting a revision of the film industry subsidies. First of all, we spent about $60 to $70 million cash for film subsidies than previous years. By the way, that's money that could go to teachers, by the way.
And how much did you get?
Well, it's kind of hard to see. The film industry counts all spending, not necessarily tax spending. Most subsidies is based upon how many taxes people pay, not just spending. But the film industry goes a step further and goes, well, the head of Iron Man 3, the lead actor, spent this much money.
Right.
And that's a little above and beyond. So what I did was, for example, the comedy show here during the Democratic Convention got approximately a $400,000 subsidy for coming to the Democratic Convention. That's $400,000 cash money.
The Daily Show.
The Daily Show. Yeah, I'm sorry, The Daily Show.
And why did they want that money? Why do they need
Because
that
it
money?
Fit the film subsidy credits, and they took it.
Okay.
They're business people, and if it's offered, they take it.
Yeah.
And they went after it.
Okay.
There were loopholes in the film subsidy. The Comedy Central should not have gotten it.
Okay.
It wasn't meant for them. It was meant for long-term studios that do long-term films.
Okay.
And that's where my proposal is, getting rid of the loopholes and then directing it toward long-term studios, some of that are interested right here in Charlotte, Winston, and Wilmington are the three major areas.
Because they're set to expire, some people are steering away from North Carolina. Some TV shows have already moved production from North Carolina because they don't want to be in the middle of something and have these things expire.
They want the subsidies.
Yeah. Exactly. So when do you think you'll have a decision on
Probably this? Within the next 2 weeks.
Really?
Yeah. And we have to. I mean, listen, if it's not next 2 weeks, that means the legislature's still in town.
And what do you think the decision will be?
I hope it's a compromise which allows us to invest in long-term capital studios, just like a long-term manufacturing plant. But I also don't think we ought to keep the loopholes where a Comedy Central takes $400,000 cash out of money that could, frankly, go to teachers and go to education.
Governor Pat McCrory.
With all respect to John Stewart.
You're welcome. I'll pass it along because, you know, we all know each other. Governor Pat McCrory, thank you for the hour.
You want to, next year, you're going to invite
sure,
me?
Sure, yeah.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our associate producer is Alexia Girodi, and the engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, visit our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Blumenthal Performing Arts Center presenting the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess tomorrow through 20th. Members of the Broadway cast perform with a 23-piece orchestra in Belk Theater. Tickets available at BlumenthalArts.org.